Okay, really, always we begin the, as everybody knows, for the last 4 years, we begin the week Sunday morning, 11:15 sharp, Eastern Standard Time. I don't know if anybody came in that early this week. You forgot to change your clock, but anyways, and 6:15 in Israel, we're back in sync after having 1 week discrepancy. So really, always a pleasure, Rabbi Liebtag. Everybody knows him, but just you know, Rabbi Liebtag. I think I met you first when you were the counselor for the Chutznikim in Gush in the early 80s. Am I correct? Yeah, so that's a served and he went to Machon Lev as a degree in, I don't know, physics or
Electro-optics.
electro-optics. Okay, there we go, electro-optics. Learned in Yeshiva now, of course, one of the leading teachers of Tanakh and Internet, and it's really been a pleasure to have him all these years. And I love his sense of humor in addition to everything else. You have to be sharp to pick up his jokes, which, but I they're cute, and I even see he's smiling at that. Okay, Rabbi Liebtag, it's all yours.
I get in trouble for those
You
more
get in
than
trouble. I like them. I won't
yeah.
get you into trouble. Okay.
So okay, we're starting a new series today, which is really a continuation of our Hashem Hu Elokim, the introduction to it. But I figured we'll start from Breshit because when we did a whole series on Navi, and my whole point of Navi was every book of Navi has a prophetic purpose, and in that whole series, which we finished in the summer. Actually, we still have to finish Sefer Malachim, but maybe we'll get back to it. But I want, because it's so important, that idea of a prophetic theme, I want to go back to Chumash and do the same thing with Chumash, because we rarely ever have a chance to do that. We study the Parsha, we study, Psukim, etc. But do we ask the question, does Sefer Bereshit have a theme? Does Sefer Vayikra have a theme that's unique to that book, which explains what's in the book and what's not in the book? And if I do find a theme for each specific book, then the question is going to be, is there one major theme for the entire five books? Or does each book, what's it called, like a trilogy? It's like three books that share some general theme, but each book stands alone. So that's going to be the question. And what I want to do today is simply explain the methodology a little bit and get our feet wet into what we're going to do. I'll say this probably 20 times, but my whole contention is, Chumash is a book to study, not read. Our assumption is the book is from God. And from my point of view, you can argue how God gave it, when he gave it, how it was written, but those are all technical questions. The essential point is that it's a book given to the Jewish people by God for us to understand how and why we're chosen, which makes sense. We would need a book like that because God chose the people forever. We have an eternal covenant with God. There is a God. God created everything. How he created, ask a scientist, why he made man, read Chumash, and why he chose us, read Chumash, etc. When I study Chumash, I'm studying what's written, not necessarily what happened. And therefore, our main study is not on proving this happened, this didn't happen, trying to understand what happened. I'm trying to understand what's written and why what's written comes to deliver the message for God, choosing a people forever. And what basically being Jewish is about. Now, let's go back to, now we have a source sheet. Okay, source sheet. I can open up my source sheet. Where we go. Share. Here we are. I'm not my own computer, but it should be okay. And here we are. There we go. Let's close up this. That doesn't look like, no, I am in. That's not good. We want to stop that share. I want to share my PDF file. Here's my PDF. Wait a second. This PDF. Why don't I find it? That's the Word file. Oh, Acrobat. Here we go. Okay. Now we're back. Move the pictures over. Okay. So here's our first source sheet, our main source sheet. Five books, one theme or five. Class number one, introduction to Sefer Bereshit. And we're going to focus today on Tzelem Elokim. Now, I want to begin with a little Dvar Torah. I'll call this a Shirin Halacha, okay? So I have what's called a Chiluk or a Chakira. We all study Halacha. That's part of being Jewish. So Halacha is how we live our life. But my claim is when we study Tzelem, it's how to lead our life. You don't read Chumash and Paskin if you're not a Karaite. You don't read Chumash and Paskat Halacha from Chumash. What the rabbis do, the rabbis study Torah, Torah Shebichtav, analyze it together with Torah Shebaal Peh, and when they have to make a decision, bottom line, now what do we do, taking everything into consideration, they're telling you the law, but instead of calling it law, mishpat, din, whatever it is, we call it halacha. I think there's a good reason. I'll open up the question for a minute here. How many people in Chumash walk with God? How would you say to walk with God? We read it yesterday.
He told
it. Et Elohim italech Noach.
Noach and Abraham.
Okay. That's the right wrong answer. Okay. God, Noach is described, was it Noach, was it Tzaddik? And he walked with God. Avram is commanded mitalech. It doesn't say Avram was mitalech with God. God commands Avram Avinu, hitalech lefanav yatamim. Now, I need Noach to appreciate Avram Avinu. If I'll use something, I think maybe it's cute. Noach was a tzaddik. Right? Avram needs to be a tzaddik. Understand the difference? A tzaddik does nothing wrong.
Hashem himself.
A tzaddik cares about other people. Now,
Avraham says, Lifanai.
What?
Lifanai is the word to be underlined in the case of Avraham. That's what God commands him, as you said.
Lifanai, Ken.
Lifanai, not mitalech, is a language of like with, together, side by side.
But this is hitalech, yeah. It's taking leadership. Now, Sue is right where the first person to holech with God is Hanoch. That was in, remember, he lived to 770 or 777, something like that. But God took him away. But I think he was in education. Why would I say Hanoch was in education?
That's what it's
for. Hanoch and Hanoch, I think they're related. So it's interesting. The first person who doesn't die, even though he died, because it says he lived for seven, how many years he would live for. The fact that it doesn't say someone died doesn't mean they didn't die. But by saying he didn't die means there's something about him that's alive forever. Remember, Yaakov Avinu lo met. Of course he did, but it didn't say by Yamot. The rabbis are onto that because he's still alive in the Jewish people. Chanoch is still alive because Chinuch keeps us alive and keeps something going. Maybe that's the word. But now let's get back to my point. The word that the rabbis use for how to live your life as a Jew is called halacha. Because in my opinion, in essence, what is the rabbi answering when a question comes up? And when a Jew asks a question, I want to walk with God. How do I walk with God? So I can ask, I can take any question to a rabbi about what's the right thing to do as a Jew in any given situation. And I can basically understand that as the person asking, my goal in life is to walk with God or walk before God, as you pointed out. And how do I walk with God or in front of God in the proper way? And the answer will be how to walk. And don't be surprised that God's opening word to Avraham Avinu is Lech Lecha. And the Akedah begins with Lech Lecha. Understand? And that's just a Dvar Torah, maybe a word. I'm not sure if it's true, but it's I think it's a nice understanding of Halacha. Right. So that's our introduction. It's not our shir. It's just a little. I want to make a distinction between studying Torah and studying Halacha. But my claim is they're connected to appreciate the depth of Halacha. And what's behind rabbinic decisions when they pass in Halacha, you have to really appreciate what's in the Torah. And if case you ever studied the Talmud, almost every Talmudic discussion begins with what pasuk, what verse do we learn this from? And the rabbis are assuming its audience studying knows the psukim and chumash and study them inside out. And based on that assumption, they discuss the meaning of the verses. And if you don't understand the verses carefully in their context, sometimes you won't understand in depth what the rabbis are saying. So now let's share our screen again and get to work. Brashit. Okay. Now, here we are. Okay. So our previous series, we traced the theme of Torah's use of two names for God. That was our Hashem Hu Elokim thing. And we based that assumption that this unique purpose of Sefer Brashit, but we didn't prove the assumption that the purpose of Brashit, we made the assumption that Brashit was in order to understand why we're chosen. We didn't go and prove that and work out the details. That'll be the series. got my my there. Okay. So our assumptions, I'll just review them as follows. We've done it before. The Torah is a book to study, not just read. Each book should have a unique prophetic purpose. And to find that, I'll just review what we've done many times. The first step in study, if the book has to be studied, not read, I first have to study the book and do an objective analysis and notice, are there key words? Is there a format? Is there a development of theme? Is there like a leitmotif? Is there a key word being repeated? And things like that. Like we just said, Noach was a tzaddik and was mitalech with Hashem. And Avram is commanded to mitalech lifnei Hashem. So that's objective. What's the meaning of it? That's subjective interpretation, which is based on that objective analysis. That's what we discuss after we do the analysis. How do we know we have something right? We'll never know for sure, but that's our discussion. The Beit Midrash decides that. And what I want to claim, if I find, if I reach some subjective interpretation that's logical, and I find that interpretation or a reflection of that interpretation in the Siddur, that's a pretty good sign that it's legitimate, if not exactly what we need to, the exact conclusion we should be reaching. Now, another technicality, which I think I've talked about before, is that no one wrote Parshat Shavua, or no one wrote what we call the Sedra. God gave us a book. God gave us five books. But each book in the Torah itself is unique. There's nine lines dividing each book. And each book has little paragraph divisions called Parshiot. But our division into Parshat Shavua was done thousands of years after the Torah was given. Part of a custom to read the entire Torah once a year and therefore divide it into some 50 sections. And therefore, every week I need approximately 100 verses to read. Now go think of a good place to start and end. So I can ask a question, why did the rabbi start Parshat Lech Lecha, where it begins and where it ends? There might be logic in that, but no one wrote, there's no theme to Parshat Lech Lecha or Parshat Chayesara. I can summarize it, they might be sharing something, but it's not an independent composition. Sefer Breshit should have a theme. Now, we might find something that ties everything in a certain Parshat Shavua together, or in the Sedra, and that might be the reason why they began there and sit there, but no one wrote it as a standalone. That's something important to take into consideration when you study Chumash. Okay, but it was the five books, and therefore I'll study each book and then try to see later on if I can find a wider theme for all five books. Okay. And now I'll call this what I call a bold assumption. Again, I'm not anchoring my class on this assumption, but I think it's logical. Okay. My claim is it's sometime or other the Torah that we have was given to Am Yisrael. I think it makes sense that Sefer Breshit was given to Am Yisrael at Har Sinai. When you read Sefer Breshit, you see it's coming from the point of view of things that the author of Breshit, which of course is God, is talking about events that happened much earlier, like Vaknani Ba'aretz and things like that. There's many verses which are assuming, which when you read the book, it seems like it's written in a later time period about an earlier time period. So it only makes sense to me that Am Yisrael in Egypt doesn't have Sefer Breshit, definitely not its entirety. They've been keeping Brit Milah probably. They've heard about their ancestors, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They know about promises of redemption one day. You know, they have what's called a Masorah. They have a tradition. I don't think they have the text as we have it. But coming out of Egypt, as they're about to stand in Har Sinai and receive the Torah, what does God do? God gives them at Har Sinai, as they about to enter a covenant, a book that explains to them who this God is, why he made man, what he expects from man, his relationship with humankind, why are there 12 tribes, who are our ancestors, who was Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, why are we doing Brit Milah, what's his promise of redemption of Brit Ben Aftarim, why are there 12 tribes, why is there so much fighting between them, etc. Basically, I need a book to explain, and also, who are the family members, who are the people of Esav, who's living in Har Seir, all these places we're going to be going to soon. I need a book to explain all that to the people. And when I read, again, the book has tremendous meaning for all generations, but it was given at one point in history, and it makes sense to me that the original audience of the book was Am Yisrael coming out of Egypt. Now, of course, it has meaning for all generations, but it's important for two reasons. It helps me understand the book itself, knowing its original audience. And if I'm going to find in Sefer Bereshit parallels to ancient Near Eastern, as you know, stories and things like that, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, which are really startling to the average yeshiva bacher when he hears about it the first time, it's almost shocking and can't believe it. The way I want to present it, I want to show you that background information, not only it's not a problem, it's important to be aware of it, because when you're aware of it, it helps us understand a lot of the complicated stories in Bereshit, which otherwise would be hard to really appreciate their deeper depth without knowing that. Now, that doesn't mean you can't study Sefer Bereshit if you don't know ancient Near Eastern, you know, myths and stories, but knowing them will enhance your study and maybe add a little extra meaning to it. Now, again, I mentioned the message is obviously for all future generations, but you always have to consider the original audience. Hope that point's clear. I'm pretty sure that's, I didn't say anything too unorthodox. Now, the most basic methodology for any book you study, what I call from list to outline, the thing, meaning first you have to make a list of topics and just look at what's in the book. Take that list of topics, turn them into an outline, the follow development of theme. And then if I can find something that ties all those themes together, then I have a book. Now, so if I take a list of what we've studied so far, we have last 2 weeks in Parshat Shavua. What do we have? We had the story of creation in Perek Aleph, chapter one. I'm just reviewing things you all know. And that was B'Shem Elohim. We discussed this in our Hashem Elohim. We did this more in detail. Chapter 2 and 3 is God and man making God in Gan Eden, a parallel creation story. And man's finally thrown out of Gan Eden. Then we have the Cain and Hevel story. And in these two stories, God is unhappy with man's behavior and does something about it. There aren't too many people around, but those are very fundamental stories about God's relationship with humankind in general. Then we have the flood story, which is the story of recreation. We need to know why God decides to recreate and what's the nature of his relationship with humankind after the flood. That'll be the rainbow covenant, etc. Then we have the Tower of Babel story, which is how we ended last week's Parsha pretty much, with the story of Migdal Bavel. Then we get to the Avram stories, which began at the end of Parsha Noach and continues through the rest of Bereshit, stories about Avram Avinu and God's interaction with Avram Avinu and the covenants he makes with him, etc. We'll study them. Then we have all these stories about Yitzchak, all the stories about Yaakov, and then all the stories about Yosef and his brothers. And then that's the end of the book. What we'll show you as we learn, each section is going to be introduced by the word, by some type of tolada. That'll form a skeleton. We're going to need that to help us develop the theme. Right now, I'm just mentioning as a technicality that almost every single unit of the book begins with something has to do with toledot, means generations or people having children. We'll see later how that's going to develop, help us understand the theme of the book. And now, if I want to make an outline of the whole book, I'm going to make a suggestion. Again, people can reach different conclusions. I think this is pretty straightforward. I begin with the creation story of how God creates in 7 days and finishes creation. Then I have many stories called like the first 11 chapters where if I'm looking for something that ties all those stories together, in each story, something's happening between man and God. And God is not happy with man's behavior. He's not happy with man's behavior in Gan Eden and does something about it. He's not happy with Cain and Hevel, or Cain for sure, does something about it. He's not happy with his entire creation and brings a flood and starts over again. And that's a new relationship when that's over and makes the first time we have a covenant. And then the builders of the Tower of Babel, it didn't say really that they sinned, but definitely God was not happy with their behavior. Something made God upset. And they sort of get a punishment, but not a punishment of destruction, a punishment of scattering. When that's over, we get the stories about our forefathers, about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, which is part three, is the main part of the book. My claim is going to be is that the purpose of this section of the first 11 chapters is basically to provide a background for the stories about our forefathers. Let me give an example. Let me stop to share for a minute. No one's asking any questions yet. Someone give me an example of how there's stories in Breshit that are going to serve as a buildup or a foil for what's going to happen later. I mean, there's a story in the first 11 chapters that's going to echo itself later on in Breshit.
Many of the stories are just a reiteration of the Eitz HaDaat, a challenge, and how is it met or not met.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, okay, so we have the forbidden fruit and the wife gives something to her husband that doesn't work out. It isn't a good idea. And he listens to her voice. Uh-huh. And then we have the repetition of that scenario with Hagar and Sarah and Avram.
But listen, I agree that there's a similarity. The question is, there could be. I'm not, what you did, I want to bring what you did. That's objective. But what? I have two stories where one story, the husband listens to his wife's voice. That gets him into trouble. And then another story where the husband listens to his wife. And now, there's some similarity between them, but they're very different. They're not the same story. They're very different. Now, is Chumash coming to teach you how to run a marriage? It could be. I'm just joking. It's Rabbi Dessen. Hope I'm joking. or is Chumash teaching you about what Sarah did? Is that a negative comment about Avram and Sarah? It might be positive. But I'm saying there's a parallel there. The question is, how strong is the parallel? And what interpretation do I do? And again, I agree there's a parallel. I don't think there's enough meat in it to reach a solid conclusion. There's enough there for Dvar Torah, but I don't think enough to find I want to hear a different example, which I want to put it made from a different angle. Give me another one that sounds a little more obvious. We talked about it before.
Building the Mishkan?
Okay, that's already in Shmuel. I want something within Breshit itself.
There's a sibling rivalry.
There's a rivalry between Cain and Hevel.
And then Yosef and his brothers.
And nothing beforehand?
Yeah, Yitzchak and Esav and Yaakov.
Do I need those rivalries to explain the later rivalries? Or it could be, I learned from there, I could learn without Chumash, I can reach a conclusion that brothers tend to fight and there's rivalries in life. Right? That's not a chiddush of Chumash. That's Chumash reflecting reality of life. Now, are those stories there? Do I need the story of Cain and Hevel to appreciate Yaakov and Lavan? Yaakov and Esav? Or Yosef and his brothers? It could be. But I can find rivalry. I'll give you another classic example. There's a lot of shidduch stories by a well. Right? Now, is that mean that going to a well is the skula for getting married? Or do people need water? In an ancient time, the source of water, they didn't have faucets in their house. Everyone went to the well to get water, and everyone needed water, and everyone went to the well, and that's where you met people. And people have to meet before they get married. So it's only logical that you find your wife by a well. Or is there something deeper about, there's some connection between a well of water and marriage? That's an example I have to take into consideration. Before you reach a subjective interpretation, you have to recognize the culture of the time and how they're living. So it's obvious that almost every marriage story is around a well of water. But that might be almost a very technical, logical reason, because that's how people got water in ancient times, and humans need water. Is there something deeper there? It could be. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm trying to be critical. Okay. One person to a couple. One second. Let me read what Molly wrote for a second. Molly wrote. Oh wait, I just hit the wrong thing. Chat. One second. Chat. I've lost my chat. I'm losing my. What happened to my chat? What did Molly? Can you say what she wrote? Or rather, wait.
I'll say if you want. One person to a couple to a family to tribe and eventually to nation, all in relationship to God. I guess the progression in.
Okay, so that's a progression of theme.
Right.
But I'm looking for something like so obvious. I want something like that's that you. It's begging interpretation, and it's real easy.
Be choosing between like the two brothers, like the choice and the focusing of the choice from generation to generation. If we have like choosing Hevel over Cain, or choosing Yitzhak over Yaakov, or choosing Yosef over his brothers, or Yehudah over his brothers. So the focus is going and progressing from generation to generation. Okay. And then we go to choosing Am Yisrael after.
Okay, so I agree with you. There's a lot of choosing between siblings going on. Is there a clear reason why God picked Hevel, Cain over Hevel?
He didn't pick Cain over Hevel. He picked Hevel over Cain.
On the Korban, but only one survived. That's a,
yeah,
is that
but
a good
then he, but I, then he got punished.
I did that on purpose. You follow?
Yeah, I follow. Yeah,
he took Hevel's Korban, but Cain survived and Hevel died. It looks like Cain survived. That's a great question, I think. So I don't learn from there what good behavior is yet. And he picks Yaakov over Esav. Is Yaakov's behavior better than Esav's? In the Midrash, for sure it is. But in Pshat,
no.
If I read Malachi, he says that there's no obvious reason. Never, God's just like one over the other. So brother, again, I agree with you. There's a theme of brother rivalry and God choosing one over another, but I don't think, but again, that's going to be really important. But the question is, how do I learn from one story to the next story?
Is the Torah inviting us to compare the character of Noah and Abraham?
Okay, so I'll take what Marty's saying. I want to use that as an anchor, because when God brings the flood, which is a massive intervention into society, and chooses Noah for the purpose of recreation, and Noah's described as what? As Ish Tzadik Tamim Hayavatortav Et Elohim Italech Noah. Ish Tamim, he was Tamim, and he walked with God. And later, when God enters a covenant with Avram Avinu, the introductory line of the covenant is, that's a smoking gun. You understand my point? Okay, that's textual. It's short. It's key words which are unique. And we rarely find them anywhere else. And they relate directly to a relationship with God, with God punishing for bad behavior and rewarding good behavior. I'm not saying they're the same people, but that's a story where the use of words, I think, are pointing directly to a message, as opposed to what you are is what you need to be. Every other example you brought makes sense to me. It's fine. There's some connection between them, but very difficult to reach a clear-cut conclusion. Now I can use that as a starting point and bring more proofs to it and buttress it. But I want to bring an example of something what I call a smoking gun. I'll give you another example. In what happened? Sorry, between books, but when Lot is saved from stone, we have Bait Mahama. Remember? And of course he eats matzah. And there's a whole bunch of parallels in the Lot story and coming out of Egypt. So many that it's almost impossible to say that there's no connection between them. Now, you could argue over what the meaning is, but Chumash is begging comparison. I'll take the easiest example. If I take the stone story and compare it later to Pilegesh B'Givah, there's no doubt that the author of the Pilegesh B'Givah story is assuming the reader knows the stone story and is making some comment about the people in Binyamin and what's happening in Am Yisrael. I don't need the Pilegesh B'Givah story to understand the story of stone, but I need the story of stone to understand the Pilegesh B'Givah story. So the reason I asked the question is I want to show you is what I want to try and do is I want to find parallels which are smoking guns, okay? Things that seem rather obvious and not maybe I'll call it kvetchy. Not that they're wrong, but I'll share with you with Rabbi Forman. You know Rabbi David Forman, right? I'm pretty sure I heard this from him. Someone asked him one time, what's this new method of Tanakh study? You know, saying all these new things. So he says it's nothing new, because for thousands of years to this day, everyone studies Chumash and says something no one ever said before. Right? It's every Dvar Torah. Some stuff more. But there's an assumption that you can say whatever you want and everyone nods very nice and it's fine. The problem is when you say something good that makes a lot of sense that you didn't notice before. And I said, no, that's, whoa, that's dangerous. I said, how can you say that makes so much sense and we never heard it before? How could that be? So that's a new approach that people are afraid of, because if no one ever said it before, it can't be true. but it makes sense. So how come no one ever said it? So that was the example he gave for the so-called new approach. Is he right or wrong? I'm not arguing. I'm just giving an example. I'm just using that example. I'm looking for something where the parallel, which is obvious. I'll try to find a objective analysis, which is comparing things which have to be meaningful. I'm going to give you one example, which I'm going to do today, which we'll do actually next week, is because it was in this week's Parsha. There was genealogies in chapter 5 from Adam to Noah. Remember? From Adam to Noah, there's 10 generations, and there's the same format. You know, this guy was born, at age this, he had children. After he had children this many years, and had more children, and all the days of that person was this many years, and he died. Remember that? And the same pattern, very wordy, repeats itself for 10 generations. The last man on the list, instead of having one child being noticed, has three children. Noach, has Shem, Ham, and Yafet, and then it ends. I have almost the exact same pattern in chapter 11, which we read yesterday. What do we find? We have actually 9 generations, but we'll deal with that, why it's 9, not 10. From Shem to Terach, and Terach has 3 sons. Almost the same format, slightly different. Now, that has to be meaningful. I'm saying what the interpretation is, but the fact that Chumash has 2 sets of genealogies, which are long with the same pattern, right, it's begging pay attention to that. Now, I'm not sure what the interpretation is, but that's begging interpretation, because that's the smoking gun parallel that must be, something must be going on. Now, I may be able to prove there's a technical reason for it and it has no meaning at all. Or if we going back to Chanoch, if we have all these genealogies and one person, right, doesn't die, it doesn't say he died, it's missing by Yamot, and his name happens to be Chanoch, which is the Hebrew word for Chinuch, and I think, does he live 777? Am I wrong or not? Does he live 777?
No, 365.
Oh, 365. Okay. I know it was
important. Lemach is.
Oh, Lemach lived 777. That's it. Okay.
Which is obviously also not coincidental.
Yeah. Okay. I knew there was, okay. I'm sleeping on the job, but I remember there's something special about the years. 365 is unique because that's how many days the flood was, in case you didn't know. You knew that? The flood was 365 days. And it makes sense that man know about 365 day year. It's not a chiddush. It's just count the days. Close enough to get to 365. And definitely not less or more. We have to add a quarter. Now back to, so I'm trying to explain my methodology. I'm in search for things which I think are begging interpretation. Okay? And that's just what I can. The opposite I call Vayomer Vayomer. Meaning, oh, this verse says Vayomer, that verse says Vayomer, or they must be connected. Everyone agrees that's pointless. But Vayitmama here and Vayitmama there, which is a strange word, okay, in the middle of a similar story, that means connected people together. Now, what's the connection? That you can argue. But before I interpret a parallel, I want to make sure I'm picking on what appears to be intentional parallels. And the other example, if I want to go from Bereshit to Shemot, is the, even in Shemot, before the flood, remember? Yetzer Adam, Rak Rak Kol Hayom. After the flood, Ramanu Rav. And makes that. Those stories are begging, compare them to each other. That's got to be intentional. If you have time, we'll get to that. Not this week. I'm just bringing examples of things you're familiar with. And the, know, and not to mention the parallel between the whole flood story in Har Sinai with 40 days and 40 nights and Matzachem B'nei Hashem. It was when both Noach and Moshe Rabbeinu are the only two characters who are saved by a teva. And the word teva there is unique. And both of them have an offer. Let me make keep you alive and kill everyone else. And both of them, it says they were found favor in God's eyes with that wording, Matzachem B'nei Hashem. And both of them have something to do with 120. And both of them have a story about 40 days and 40 nights. That's begging interpretation. What the meaning is, you can argue. I'm trying to give examples, what I call smoking guns. I hope that's clear. And that's why I'm glad that you gave other examples, which I'm saying they're not wrong and they're parallel, but what I'm searching for is something that everyone would agree on. Again, not what the interpretation is, but that Chumash is begging interpretation. And that's what we're going to go with. Now let's get to work. I guess we're only going to have time today to do Perek Aleph and Breshit, which is a good place to start. Now, I'll read the chat in a minute. I'm going to read the chat. What I want you to do for a minute, if you have a Chumash open up Perek Aleph and Breshit. I'm going to share my screen with you in a minute. But look for patterns or format to Perek Aleph and Breshit. I'm sure you've seen it before, but if I'm looking, what does every day of creation have in common? Understand my question? We have every day of creation is unique, something different every day. But there's certain things that every day shares, a certain format. Just think for a minute, what are the obvious parallels between every day of creation?
Vayi erev, vayi vivoker.
Yeah, that's the example. Give me a second. Keep checking.
Tov. The word tov is appearing. And it
the word tov, very good. That's
seven
very good.
Times, I think.
Who said tov?
I did.
That's very good.
Yeah.
I have to use jokes today. Thank you, Jay.
Okay. It's creation and evaluation.
Okay. There's
mode is only one.
Which is special because of tov.
Right.
Okay.
It's one of the seven.
Okay.
But it adds the ma'ud.
Yeah. So what I want to do now, just give me a second. Keep looking. I want to find, why can't I find the chat? Wait, here's the chat. Okay, now I got it. Yeah. Okay, now we got it. Okay. I didn't check the chat before. Give me a break. Hanukkah 365, Noach and Avram. Okay. Okay, that's good. Ripin of Tarim. Okay. And okay, that's great. Okay, Esav marries Kenite, wasn't that? Okay. Okay. Okay, I see what we say in the thing. Sorry, someone mentioned that also Eov is called Tamim. And I agree that I think there's key words in the book of Eov that make it a commentary on Sefer Breshit. What the meaning of those there's definitely Eretz Utz and Tamim and Tzadik, and it's not the same story, but there's enough parallels between Eov's story and Avraham Avinu that begs there must be some underlying reason for the composition of Eov that relates to a question that comes up in Sefer Breshit, but that's for Shirin Eov. Now, so let's get to work on Parshat Breshit, and I'm going to share a different screen now. Where are we? Wait a second. Another one more chat here. Oh, I think I have my mouse here. Here we go. Okay, that's it for the chats. Okay, I want to share my screen and go back to my Acrobat. Here we go. And I also sent you this file, I hope. And I gave it last week and I told you I'd send it again. I hope everyone has it. And I'm going to have trouble sharing it. But first, I'm going to look at the whole picture. This page, which is nicely formatted, I can take credit for it myself. This is a page which formats basically chapter one of Breshit. Right? And it's pointing out what I think are obvious parallels. So first I'm looking at the whole page. I know you can't read it. It's too small to read, but it's enough to see the pattern. Every day begins with Vayomer Elokim. That's got to be obvious. Every parshia from day two, because every parshia from day two to day six begins with Vayomer Elokim, then I have to assume that day one begins in Pasuk Gimel, where there's then a parshia with Vayomer Elokim, which makes the first two Pesukim a type of introduction. But that's fine. Now, if I'm wondering what did God make on day zero or day one, does day one begin with Pasuk Aleph or day one begin with Pasuk Gimel? Yeah, Asher? Oh, Pasuk Gimel, you're saying. Okay. I think it's obvious that that's where structure and paying attention to structure and format helps you understand how to read Pasuk Aleph and Bet. And then when I look at it, if God doesn't make Shemaim until day two and Arts until day three, then Rishi Bar Lukim et Shemaim Arts is an introduction to at least the first 3 days of creation, if not more. Then we have to pay attention to the verb bara. No, it's, but Aleph and Bet is introductory and Gimel begins creation. Now, someone mentioned before, which is as obvious as could be, every day ends with the same phrase, Vayer Vay Boker Yom Shishi. Remember, Vayer Vay Boker Yom, where's that? Yom Chamishi. I'm missing something there. I missed the pasuk. Wow. At the end of day five. No, I didn't. Here it is. Vayer Vay Boker Yom Chamishi. Vayer Yom Revi'i. Got it? You see that? Now, that alone is as simple as could be. That every day of creation begins with Vayomer Elokim and ends with Vayer Vayboker. And that's enough to tell me that format is important and the structure. That doesn't mean it has meaning, but it means it's something to pay attention to. Now, if I follow now, what is it that God says? But I want to show you now, every time God says something, Vayomer Elokim, I think we discussed this before, I want to clarify it though. Every Vayomer Elokim, there's a big question, who's God talking to? And then you have the philosophical question, if someone talks and no one's listening, did he say anything? Is there sound if no one hears? But that's not taught, that's just an interesting question, not for here. But it is interesting that Chumash is using the verb of speech, right? To God who doesn't have any, you know, we know that guy doesn't know what he is. We know that he is, but it's clear to us that God is not human, but we describe God in human terms. So you almost have to reach the conclusion that the Torah's description of God in human terms is there to help us relate to God. It's not a description of God, but enables us to relate to God and how we need to behave. And that'll be a theme that'll be quite easy to prove as you go through Chumash. Now, if I want to pay attention, what follows every Vayomer Elokim? It's always going to be a command. For example, now we make it a little bit bigger because we don't need the bigger picture yet here. So on the first day, Vayomer Elokim Yehi Or, command. Day two, Yehi Rakia, a command. Day three, Yekavu HaMayim, let the water gather together to one place, a command. Day four, let there be lights, Perkei HaShamayim. Day five, Yishtishtu HaMayim, let the waters spread out with, spring out fish and birds. Okay. And day six, what's God say? Day six in the beginning is, let the land bring out living things. So it's quite obvious, every Vayomer Elokim at the beginning of each day is a statement by God followed by a command. Or basically, God's giving a command. Yeah. Who's God commanding? Unclear, but you'll have to see who does it. Now, if I follow the pattern, I hope that's clear. Every day begins with Vayomer Elokim followed by a command and ends with Vayer Vay Boker, and now we're making progress. Now, who fulfills the command? Let's take a look. Day one is always easiest. Let there be light command, followed by Vayor, and there is light. If you daven Pesukei Zimra this morning, there's a pasuk you read which really said, Hu Amar V'Yehi. He said, and it happened. Hu Tziva V'Yamod. So, Tehillim, we're paying attention to that idea already. Now, I can ask a question. If God's going to do it anyhow, why start with God saying let there be something and do it? So if I follow this pattern, that every opening command that Elohim says is followed by its execution, should just tell me that God did it. Just say, Vayas Elohim et Arakia, or Vayas Elohim, Vayivrazim et Or, something like that. Why? What's the necessity for God to speak before he acts? Or God to plan before he acts? Now, that's based on objective analysis. I'm trying to explain my methodology. When you objectively look at the story of creation, every day begins with a command by Elohim and its execution, usually by Elohim, and ends with a Vayer Vay Boker with a lot of things in between. But when I look at that, ask myself, does that seem necessary? If the whole goal is to tell you that what? That God made everything, just say God made everything. Now, someone tell me a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that that relates to that question. Someone named me a mission in Pirkei Avot.
Rama Marot Nivra Olam.
That's right. The rabbi saying that we're in Pirkei Avot, is that, remember?
Yeah,
it says there were four Asra Mamrot Nivra Olam. And what's the question? That means there were 10 times the God says Vayomer in creation, even though it's hard to find all 10, but we'll assume 10.
There are only 9.
Yeah, okay. That's Gemara asked that question, and they come up with another pasuk.
But he could have done it with one.
He could have done that. Main thing is he could have done it with one.
Right.
And then it's come, now that Mishnah is key for my methodology, or our methodology, or the methodology. That what? The Mishnah is reading Chumash, it's studying Chumash and noting a pattern that in creation, even though God could have just said, "Let there be nature," and there was nature. Or let there be sun, moon, stars, and everything that we're familiar with. Instead, intentionally, Chumash has creation in 6 days, and each day begins with God saying he's going to do something and doing it. Now, what the Mishnah is basically assuming is that pattern begs interpretation. And they suggest an interpretation, but the subjective interpretation is not important for now. What's important for me is the methodology that when Chumash does something like that, it's begging interpretation because it's a book to study. I'm saying the same thing over and over again, but it's really important because I want to clarify that. Because I want to show you it's just I'm doing it. Chazal do it. And the book is begging that people do that. The problem is, how do I know what's the correct interpretation? So what our minhag is, we study it and we share our thoughts with each other and we cut each other down, depending who the teacher is. Some of the nice teachers, all of that, everything's fine. Some teachers say only my opinion counts. If I look notes, how do you find the balance between sharing your opinions maturely, but not going crazy about it, but also not thinking only my opinion counts? And that's already and has to do with hashkafa and teaching styles, etc. But there's no doubt the rabbis love to argue, don't they? But they argue l'shem shamayim. They argue how to interpret. Now we'll see later on when you become postmodern, and we're old enough to be postmodern. I mean that it could be, there is no one absolute interpretation. God wants us to argue about it maturely. And what's called kapatish yifotzei tzela, the words of Torah are so powerful, it enables multiple interpretation. And the same parallel might have multiple meanings. And there's no doubt the rabbis do that all the time. Now, does that mean everyone, now, which one's correct? How do you find correct? But then that's already more a philosophical question. I'm just trying to show with you the methodology that the first step you have to do is a critical read, what's called objective analysis. And I'm trying to show you an example of the critical read. Now, going back to creation, I'm going to show you something which I think is cute. Let's see who executes it. Now, the simplest execution is Vayichen. It happened. Don't say anyone did it, but it happened because who amar v'yehi? Remember that pasuk? Sometimes it just happens. Sometimes it says explicitly that God did it. Vayas Elohim. And the verb that we find most often in creation, when there is an act of creation, it's executed by God, it's the verb is asiya, Vayas Elohim. Every once in a while, you're going to have the word bara. Does that make sense? Sometimes just Vayichen. Sometimes it'll say Vayas Elohim, God will do it. And sometimes it'll say Vayivra Elohim instead of Vayas. Now, that has to be significant. Got it? And therefore, what's that beg to do? Take a look. When does it say Vayivra? Now, maybe nothing will come up special, but if I find Vayivra at key points, like when God makes man, for example, I have a new bara, I'm assuming that's significant. Now, again, what's significant about it, I'm not sure yet, but I'm still part in my objective analysis. If it seems to be random, that's something else. Now, if God says to do something and someone else does it, whoa. If every single time God says do something and God does it, what happens? And in one time or in one unique time, someone else does it, I think that begs interpretation. I'm going really slow today, but I'm not used to doing this. But I'm going to be doing this for the whole book. So I want to base what we're doing or anchor what I'm doing and hopefully something that makes sense. Let's go to Let's go back. Okay. So let's take a look again now. I'll share my screen again. I apologize for everything being in Hebrew, but I need the Hebrew for the, I'll go to English text in a minute, but right now everything's in Hebrew because it's,
you need the
complicated format. And most of you people, this is simple Hebrew and creation. Okay. So let's go back. We'll make it nice and big. And we're going to see who does the creation day by day. But we know that God gives the command. Who executes the command? And later we'll also pay attention to what God does in addition. Of course, I should have mentioned, almost every day, God reflects and gives himself a report card. He reflects on what he did and evaluates. Okay. So the first day is as simple as could be. He or, by he or, it happened. Okay. And then what does God do? God sees it's good. Elohim sees it's good. Nice and simple. Then lahavdil, right? God separates between light, dark, and night, between light and darkness, and he gives out a name. He calls the or yom, the night he calls day, and he calls it a day, pun intended. And the only thing, day one, he makes day and night, he makes light and dark, and he calls one night and one day. Now, when you study the book, this is really almost impossible to follow because we don't have the sun and the moon until day four, which in my opinion is screaming, don't take this story literally because it doesn't fit science. I'm not talking about quantum mechanics and Big Bang. I'm just talking about obvious. It's almost obvious to everybody that sun and moon relate, the sun relates to day and night. But the fact that I have day and night without a sun and a moon yet is almost telling you from day one, don't take this literally, but take it seriously. Now, day two. What's special? Elohim says what? Yirakia betoch hamayim. Bimavdil b'mayim mayim. God wants there to be a rakia holding up the water to separate between water above and water below. Okay? And who does it now? Vayas Elohim et harakia. Elohim makes the rakia. And what he said he would do. And that divides between the water above and the water below. Okay? And there's no evaluation on this day. Why? Unclear. And again, by Hichenin it happens. Then again, God, like he did on day one, he gives a name to its creation. He calls the rakia shamayim. That's water is there, sham, there. There's water up above. And what stops the water above from falling? The rakia, whatever that might be.
Yeah. What's the subject of the verb vayavdeil? What's the subject of the verb vayavdeil?
The rakia does it. The God made.
God does it.
God, God. God did it or the rakia did it?
I think you're right, but I don't think it's obvious.
Okay, the way I understand it, because God made the rakia, and what did the rakia do? But look, he says, God, let there be a rakia, and let the rakia mavdil b'mayim l'mayim.
That's right.
So God made the rakia, and the rakia did what God wanted it to do. B'mavdil v'yavdil.
That's right. It's relating to the former pasuk. So
yeah,
we
yeah. Did you check the English translations on it? If you find a translation things differently, it'd be interesting. But I think that's a simple translation. Okay. What bothers me here is that why is Vayichen at the end? Usually Vayichen comes first. Here Vayichen comes at the end. That I never figured out. I never when it says Vayichen by itself and when Vayichen before he does it and Vayichen after he does it, I'm confused there. I've been trying, but I can't find a pattern. If someone finds a pattern, please share it with me.
That's why I suggested it might be possible to understand the subject of the verb vayavdeil is God.
God did it.
God is doing the action. And now, only when all of the whole picture has been painted, does it say vayichen.
Yeah, but maybe thanks to the shidfus. The fact that God made the rakia and the rakia did what it was supposed to do. Someone mentioned the Mishkan later on. If you remember the Mishkan, like really wordy, all Truma Tetzav is Vasita, 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 you make. And then Vayas, Moshe, or Vayas, Aham, no, it's the people, no, it's God says to do it and we do it. And that's why the Mishkan and creation go beautifully hand in hand because we become this new partner with God in creation. If I want to go like long term, I think I need the creation story is critical to understand the Mishkan, but that's, another book.
The Koran Tanakh English translation says, and God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament.
So it's unclear who the divided goes on. It sounds like God, but you could read it either way.
Current
it didn't say he divided. It didn't say and it divided, right?
No, but it says and divided.
Okay, but is that could be referring to the Rakia? If I was the English teacher, I'd send it back to the translator and say, unclear.
Exactly.
Because the divided can go on the Rakia. I remember getting in trouble on things like that. I still make those mistakes. Isn't that a classic unclear sentence? It needs a he or an it. No, it's unclear. And if it said it or he, it would be clear.
The opposite.
What do you mean?
It explicitly says that God did it.
He didn't say he with an H, was he?
The translation.
But the translation is not clear. It says clearly that the rakia, it describes the rakia. Vehim avdil ben maim lemaim, and then he made the rakia, and the rakia separated.
Okay. Okay, that's not our... I'm just showing you how you have to read carefully, and there's room for either way, but that's what's fun to do. That's not our topic today, but it's a fun... I want you to get you into studying Chumash, that's all. And what Asher's doing, what we're doing, most people don't even think of doing. Understand? Most people just read it and don't just finish the Aliyah and they're done.
But it's a good example of that translation is interpretation.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I told you, for fun one day, if you want to, if you're bored one day, go through the first five chapters of Chumash, look at the word Adam, yeah, and ask yourself, is it a common noun or a proper noun? Is it talking about Adam the person or Adam the species? And then look at all the English translations you have at home and see how all the translators dealt with it. How they translate Adam. Do they translate Adam with a capital A, Adam with a small a? They say humans, mankind, civil, like, it's so much fun to watch. And you'll see the more modern translations, older translations. It's a lot of fun. Okay, now let's go on. We're going to run out of time. Oh, it's not good. I ran out of time already. That's not good. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm in the middle. Let me just get to one point because I'm not going to get to my main point today. I apologize. Look at day three. That's what's left to pick up on next week. But Elohim says what? God saying, let the water recede and let the land come up. It didn't say that God didn't say, let there be Yabasha. It seems like Yabasha was always there, just like the water was always there. That's a philosophical question. No, what was there before creation? Ask your local philosopher. I don't think Chumash deals with that question. And Rambam says, base your answer on common sense, not on Chumash, because from Chumash, if you believe that creation was always there, Chumash can support it. If you believe it had to be created, Chumash can support it. So we're not going to go that direction. What's important for me is how Chumash tells the story. So God's saying, let the water that's there already, below the land, below the sky, settle down to one place, okay? And let the water, and let the land be seen. Like, it sounds like the land was there already. And by chen, it happened, and that's it. Didn't say how God did it, but it happened. Because there's really not much to do. But the water, I guess, listens to God. See, yikabu like a mikveh maim. That's cute. And same thing's going to happen in the flood if you paid attention. Although everything's covered with water and the water recedes and you see the land. Remember, if you follow the flood story, we know that they have the same wording, not topic for today. Then God is giving out names again and he calls the Yabasha Aretz. And now that the water is separated from the land, he can call the Mikveh Maim Yamim. Not just the water below, but the water below where there's no land is Yamim. And it's evaluated. What's the Chiddush of day three? Day three, there's two acts of creation. This will be our last topic for today, but it's important. The last topic of creation is when Elohim makes vegetation. But three is the first time I have two acts of creation on the same day. Everyone knows this only from when people get married on a Tuesday, because it's Pamayim Ki Tov. But there's a technical reason why it's Pamayim Ki Tov, why it's twice Tov, because there's two evaluations on the third day. Because there's two acts of creation on the third day. Two times God says he's going to do something. Command, execution, evaluation. We call that par. Let's look at what happens. Elohim says, Tatshei ha'aretz deshe, esa mazura se'ez priyo sapri. What's the command? Let the land give what vegetation? I call bird priya adama and bird priya eitz. Understand? What we call bird, basically that's the brachot we make are based on that. If you know Rabbi Yehuda in Masechet Brachot, he has an opinion bring me the shayim because of this pasuk, but that's for those who know their Mishnah. But for us, God's telling the land to make vegetables and fruit with the ability to reproduce themselves. Basically, this is the first life form in creation. There's a big, from 3A to 3B, whoa, we have a quantum leap in evolution. We're going from inanimate to life, okay? Now, let's see who does it. Oh, by Hichen, it happened. Look at the next line. Batotzei ha'aretz desha esa mazri azera. Who does it? Did anyone pay attention to that? And
Sabbath Rishi? The land.
The land does it.
Why does it say Vayichen before it did it?
Who says before he did it? Maybe this is a klal and a prat. And here's how it happened. Okay, Vayichen, and here's how it happened. It happened how? Because who am I? Because God said Totzeres. Now, to prove you this is special, look at day six. Right here. It's a perfect battle, okay? Ve'emrelim, Totzei ha'aretz nefesh chaya lemina, ve'emar remes chaya eretz lemina, ve'yichen, ve'yatzelim et chayat ha'sadeh. You see the parallel? That's awesome, isn't it? That's got to be important. Chazal pick up on it, for sure. But the fact that God's telling the land to do something doesn't mean the land has to do it. Here he's saying, God's saying here in the command, Tatshe ha'aretz deshe samazri azera, vatotzi ha'aretz deshe. The land does it. Here Elohim says, Totzi ha'aretz nefesh chaya, and Elohim does it, and both have Vayichen beforehand. So Vayichen has to be the introduction of how it gets done. Got it? Now, the rabbis call this the sin of the land. Let me share with you my understanding of this, and then I got to call it a day. I got to call it a share. Jay got me started with my stupid jokes. Now, what's the problem? We're talking about creation, obviously, but ancient man saw nature. If you living in nature, in a jungle, and you see nature, and you see growth, and you see vegetation, and you look at, hey, there's a tree, and the tree gives fruit, and there's land, you put a seed in whatever it is, even if you don't put a seed in, the land is growing trees and growing vegetables and vegetation. Where's that power coming from? We call it Mother Nature, but they called it Asher. They called it, there's got to be a God in charge of fertility of the land. It's only logical. And because people needed food that grows from the land, don't be surprised that people developed a culture where they believe the land has God type that is, has power. And there must be some power in charge of fertility, enabling the land to give its fruit and produce crops, etc. I need those crops to make bebelach, to make rogelach, to make food to survive. And it's out of my control. But maybe if I make special prayers or feed them or something like that, or bring a sacrifice to them or praise them, maybe I'll get better crops. But it really is, hey, I need rain. You follow? I need water from heaven. So maybe there's a rain god in charge of fertilizing that land. And we have Baal and Asherah. Understand? And it's so logical what they've done. And that leads to idol worship, which makes perfect sense, idol worship, doesn't it? Now, Chumash is fighting idol worship because the name for many gods is Elohim. But by conjugating many gods in the singular, by Yomer Elohim, we're teaching one god. I'm just touching the surface where the this little technicality here when I'm checking who am I? God says and God does, with that one exception, it has to be important. And let me just jump ahead a little bit. Remember, this is the second act of creation on day three. On day six, also has two acts of creation because we all know the parallels between them. What does God make? On day six, the second part of day six, on the same day he makes Bari Praetz and Bari Pei Adama, he makes man. Here it says, Vayomer Elohim, Nase Adam, for some reason plural, we'll deal with that later on. But Samein Kidmotenu. And they're in charge of everything that I made on day four, on day five and six, everything living. And then by Yivra Elohim et Adam, who does it? God said to do it, and God does it, but with a bara. The bara is new. But he makes man b'tzelem Elohim, because Elohim has been creative every day. And he blesses them with pru urvu. And his diet, man gets to eat. Esev zoreh zera and koitz. Man gets to eat bari prey adama and bari prey eitz. And animals get to eat yerek esev. We'll deal with that later on. But you can't miss that 6B is with 3B to go hand in hand. They're created. Now, God makes man, but how? B'tzelem Elohim. Now, what's B'tzelem Elohim? What's God been doing ever since day one? Being creative, thinking about doing something and doing it. So just like the land appears to be creative and be a god, man is also super creative and thinks he's a god. Because he has creative ability, just like God says, what can man do? Man thinks, the land grows things, seems naturally. Man thinks about doing something. He plans. He's an architect. He's an engineer. He plans something, right? And then he does it, and he should, he can evaluate it. He should do good. He might do bad. That we'll see later on. But the fact that the two most creative creations of God are the land, called Mother Nature, and man himself was able to do things, and the recognition that even though there appears to be that man is a god with his creative ability, his creative ability is a gift from God, and maybe a responsibility from God. I'm jumping slowly from a objective analysis. I'm suggesting a subjective interpretation, which I think Chumash is begging when I read the rest of Chumash. Because if I'm going to come up with an interpretation, if I see it, if I see man's going to be commanded what to do with his creativity and what to do with them, don't be surprised in Gan Eden, man's commanded, right, to work the land, right? But God's going to plant the garden. It's going to be God's garden, not Earth's garden, right? And man's job is to work it and be use the creativity with it, but not to think he's a god. And to show God, anyway, that's going to be more. Okay, I'm way over time already. But I hope you understand what I'm trying to do today. I only got halfway through my source sheet, but I'm not in a rush anymore because I'm not have to finish. It's not a share on the parsha. You follow? I want to share with you. I rarely have time. I always have to rush through something. I want to just learn like I'm in class without time thing. I'm going to learn Breshit together and try to show you how, what this methodology of finding a theme. And there's room for argument, but I want to take it slow and basic because it's an important book that God gave us to read and study, not to know. It's not a science book, how God did it. It's to understand what's the meaning of Tzedlan Elohim, what's the meaning of our relationship with God, which I think is a firm approach. Okay, I'll stop here. Actually, I'm going back to Israel now. I'm going to the airport in a couple of minutes. So we pray for peace and keep the skies open for at least another day or two.
And see you tova.
Okay, thank you, everybody.
Okay.
We'll continue this next week. Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Dr. Ben, Chatzi Shabbi Vriti, Vira Shir Shalom, Sefer Tehillim, Yatgil Bachad. Tomorrow, Mark Shapiro will give his last class in this series on the Musar dispute. And then next week, he's going to go back to his great rabbinic figures, series, Rishmo Mohiliver.
Rabbi Jay?
Yes.
Here we go. I'm getting contagious. Because someone made a joke like mine. The last comment from Jack.
Okay.
Yes. And he says, and the shear was good.
Oh, the shear is good. People will begin to appreciate sense of humor. It's okay.
They're catching on. Okay.
Yeah. They don't always get all the jokes, and you got to be sharp. But okay, everybody. And when he talks to kids, to adults, we all get them. But goodbye. Have a good trip. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
And Tuesday, Rabbi
Shmuel. But not so mode, okay?
Yeah. Tuesday, I just have left people what's going on, thanks.
Rabbi Liebtag, how was Hillcrest this morning?
Nice, I had a good time.
Yeah. Big showing?
Yeah, nice turnout. There's bagel and lox, how can you not come?
Good.
So we talked about Bris Mila because there's bagels and lox.
Good. Nesiat tova.
Okay.
Okay, there we go. Thanks. Okay, okay, all right. Rabbi Liebtag likes to tour a lot and gives shirim all over. He's a magishir everywhere we go. Okay, Tuesday, Rabbi Shulman is beginning his new series, the year-long series on Sefer Yeshua. Wednesday, Rabbi Helfgott is beginning his year-long series on the second half of Sefer Yeshayahu. Thursday, Rabbi Yitzchak Get Shalom will be giving our parsha shir. And Friday, on Thursday, of course, Ari Zivitovsky will be a special. So well. It's not. Friday, give my sitter share, and I think that's it. Okay. I guess you can talk once I leave. It doesn't matter. Okay. Everybody, be well, and invite a friend to join. And have a Shavua Tov, Kodesh Tov, and all good things. Thanks a lot. Be with everybody.